For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios in Camden. I'm your host Red Sale, back in my broom cupboard.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, recording from the bedroom. And coming up in today's Read On, American author Laurie Nelson Spielman takes us on a romantic trip to Italy in one Italian summer.
Simon Stevenson discusses Set My Heart to Five, his hilariously funny debut novel that's already been snapped up by Hollywood.
And talking of books that become films, from the archives, I speak to Tony Hawks about the book and movie Playing the Moldovans at Tennis. All that plus a double Books of Your Life coming up in today's Read On.
Every so often I get a press release for a book that makes me go, I've got to read that, which is exactly what happened with Set My Heart to Five by Simon Stevenson. It's his debut novel, and he joined me from his home in Los Angeles, where he's already working on the screenplay for what promises to be a major new film. So, Simon, rather than my telling the audience what the book's about, why don't you?
Set My Heart to Five is the story of an android called Jared. And if you're not a science fiction person by default, which I have to confess I amn't exactly, an android tends to be a human-type body with a computer-type brain. My book is set in 2054, at a time when we do have androids and they're human bodies, and someone's just realized that with all the fancy new DNA technology, the CRISPR technology, to really make a good android, all you have to do is take the DNA for a human brain and take out the bit that codes for consciousness and replace it with the source code for Windows 95. And then you would have a programmable android who will do whatever you like. Of course, being humans, we are going to make the androids do all the jobs that we don't want to do. The narrator of the book is a dentist. Androids will be wonderful dentists because they don't have any empathy. So they're not going to be put off if you're complaining or crying or screaming. The android will get that wisdom tooth out every time. Being humans, though, we're, of course, naturally very protective of ourselves. And the one advantage that we have over artificial intelligence is that we have feelings and they don't. So in this future world of 2054, anytime an android starts to show any hint of feelings, we either wipe them or incinerate them. We swiftly get rid of them. So Jared lives in the American Midwest and he's just doing his tasks, doing his dentistry. And one day he starts to have what seem to be feelings. That sets him off on a journey and adventure to try and save himself and others like him. And one of the key things that helps him understand feelings and learn to feel is movies. So he watches a lot of old movies.
And through films, Jared begins to discover feelings within himself. And this sparks a road trip and a chase across the United States.
Yes. So in 2054, the organization who are charged with managing androids and making sure that they don't have feelings is a department called the Bureau of Robotics. The central joke around the Bureau of Robotics is that they're much like the Department of Motor Vehicles, the DMV here in the US, who are notoriously slow and incompetent and nothing ever happens when it should. If you ever saw the movie Zootopia, there's a scene where the animal characters go to the DMV and everyone working there is portrayed by sloths, and it's just everything moves in incredibly slow motion. So the Bureau of Robotics was kind of inspired by the DMV in the, you know, they're very slow moving, but nonetheless, they do have this terrible power and threat over Jared. So the world in 2054, as I've imagined it, is sort of all too human. It's not a dystopia. I've been calling it a mystopia. So it's much like our current world, except things are just mostly a bit worse. For instance, there's been a terrible data loss event, a great crash. But the reason why that's occurred is because, you know how when you forget your email password, and then it sends it to your old recovery email account, and then it asks you who your favorite teacher was and who your first pet was. Basically, on a critical day in 2037, a critical mass of humans forgot the names of their first teacher and their beloved first pet, and it led to the entirety of humanity being forever locked out of the internet. So in 2054, we live in a strange world where we have some new technology like androids, but equally we lack a lot of things. So we don't really have planes anymore because planes all fell out of the sky when the internet crashed and the airlines are all still suing each other to work out who's liable. And that's the world Jared kind of comes of age in. And then the other thing to say is the movies that he watches, of course, they have killer robot sagas, but he doesn't want to watch those movies because he's a robot himself, so he's not very into that. And actually, the movies that have become classics are the movies that I kind of grew up on. So the movies of the 80s and 90s, really, which obviously have their flaws. But the one thing they always have, I think, is they're always big-hearted. So I'm thinking about movies like Big or Forrest Gump or Sleepless in Seattle. I realize I've just named three Tom Hanks movies there. I think maybe that's part of the point is, you know, he is always very good at doing the heart in the movies, isn't he? So our android Jared ultimately tries to teach humans that androids like him should be allowed to feel.
And something that really comes through both in your voice and from the press release is it's a funny book. It's a satirical book, but with a big heart that explores what it is to be human.
I think that's really the hope. Absolutely, Red. I mean, I'm always so cautious of saying, you know, when people say, describe your book. And of course, I want to say, well, it's funny. But funny is so subjective, isn't it? That like, I'm always nervous of claiming it's funny. But I hope people find it funny. Other people have found it funny. A lot of that is cohesive with my basic take on the world, that there's a lot of terrible stuff in the world. But sometimes you have to laugh, right? And so, for instance, in the book, there's no longer a moon by 2054 because Elon Musk incinerated it. He incinerated it in, you know, what at the time he believed was a hilarious prank, but what he now says was an accident, which seems about right. At the rate we're going, these things which I wrote as comic satire, you're sort of like, well, sure, why not? Like, that could easily happen in the next 20 years.
Are you a big fan of satire?
Satire is a funny word, isn't it? Because when I think of satire, and I don't know if it's just, you know, growing up in the 1980s, but I think of something like Spitting Image, which was hilarious, but was really kind of, I think satire has a really strong element of mockery in it sometimes. And I'm definitely really interested in emotion and heart and feelings. And I think the best of both worlds is if you can be funny, but then also hopefully try and bring some heart and some feelings as well, because I think as humans, we like both those things. And I don't like reading things that are kind of mean-spirited, and definitely that's not what I try and write. I think the danger with satire sometimes is that you can trip over into that territory.
And I suppose that's what Jared is actually looking for, the meaning in life, the emotions that make people tick.
Exactly. And I think so much of that is drawn from personal experience. I wrote the book at a time when I was living by myself in a new city. The relationship I'd been in had ended. And so I was feeling quite isolated. And Jared has this thing where he kind of yearns for human connection. He wants to be amongst people and he wants to be included in things. But yet he doesn't quite know how to do it. He doesn't know the right thing to say, and he worries about saying the wrong thing. And, you know, as a sometime lonely introvert myself, even though he's an android, I think what I've tried to do is give him some very recognizable human things that maybe a lot of us can relate to.
By your accent, you're a Scot currently living in Los Angeles.
Wow, perfect. I am so thrilled that you said that, because what I hear an awful lot is you don't sound very Scottish. And I always feel sort of mildly ashamed by that, because I am Scottish. I'm from Edinburgh. I lived in London for about 10 years, and then I've been out here in the US for 6 or 7 years now. So I think, unfortunately, the accent does go. And I found myself saying garage and tomato without deliberately choosing to. So I'm definitely worried that another 5 years and I'll probably have an American accent.
You've had a data update or been rewired.
Exactly, which would be great, because then I could just undo the update and return to my actual accent.
I think you are the first author I have spoken to who, even before the book has been published, is working on the screenplay for the Hollywood movie version. And you're working with another expat, I believe, Edgar Wright, who famously created Shaun of the Dead and Baby Driver.
Yes, absolutely. So I got incredibly lucky in that my day job for the past years has been as a screenwriter. So I worked on something with Edgar's producers. And when I finished the manuscript of the book. I emailed them and, you know, asked if they might be interested to read, and they knew it was the longest shot in the world because he's such a wonderful filmmaker and we're all his great fan, and I'm sure he gets inundated with books all the time. But they liked it and they passed it to him and he liked it, and suddenly there was a potential movie version. And I think in hindsight, it's a great thing as a screenwriter to write the book, because then you kind of fairly automatically get the job to write the script as well. So normally what would happen with a project that had a big director like Edgar Wright involved, I mean, he tends to write himself anyway, and he's a brilliant writer. But if you're working with someone of that caliber, what would tend to happen would be the studio would go out to 12 writers and you would all have to schlep into the studio and go and pitch your take on it. And you'd spend weeks working up your pitch, and then you'd go and invariably I wouldn't get the job. And so actually writing the book first to mean that you get the job to write the screenplay seems like a much better model to me from this distance.
And have you got anybody in mind for the part of Jared?
I actually don't. So it's funny, sometimes I caught myself doing that when I've written other things. And I think it's a little bit dangerous because I think you end up writing whatever the stereotype of that actor is. Like, I always say that I adore the English actor Bill Nighy. I think he's wonderful. But I think that at a certain point, like, writers now probably they don't even make up a character name. They probably just put Bill Nighy in the script because he just comes in and has to play a very similar person. So I try and steer away from that. And then I think the other thing to say is, as the writer, you don't really get a say in that. Like, that's really the director's call. I think there's lots of people who do it wonderfully in truth. And I'm kind of just really excited to see if and when it happens, how they do it.
But he would be more likely to be a Simon Pegg than an Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Perhaps, yeah. I'm thinking the book, Jared is in his 40s, and part of the thing with androids is that they're created to be as ordinary and as non-offensive as possible. So yeah, they don't really look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. They probably do look more like Simon Pegg. He's definitely not the Terminator. He's more just a very ordinary human.
And in the meantime, the book has been brought to life as an audiobook. Did you have anything to do with the selection of the narrator for that?
I did a little bit, because we all agreed it was so important to get the right voices, because this book is a comedy. And so there's a lot of sort of like subtle jokes. And the other thing is to say it's all sort of written in the first person voice of the android. So we kind of needed someone that could do the first person voice of an android and kind of land the jokes and simply just recognize where the jokes were. And we actually listened to quite a few people and we had lots of great options, but HarperCollins found one actor who just really seemed to get it. I heard the sample and straight away I said, yeah, this is the person.
Hi, my name is Jared. I am sincerely pleased to meet you. Also, I am a bot. Unless you have been living under a rock in North Korea or New Zealand, you of course know what a bot is. Nonetheless, I am programmed to relay the following dialogue to each new human I encounter. Please do not be fooled by my human-like appearance. I am a mere bot. I do not have feelings or anything else that might be misconstrued as a soul. Instead, I have been programmed to a high level of proficiency in dentistry. Should you have any concerns, please immediately report me to the Bureau of Robotics. But humans rarely find this information calming. Instead, they see a fellow human standing in front of them claiming that he is not a human. This bamboozles them. It often bamboozles them so profoundly that they exclaim, "But you look so human." I then patiently explain to them what they anyway already know, that my body looks human because it is indeed a human body. It is engineered from DNA and constructed of cells the exact same way their own body is. It has the same basic needs: food, water, oxygen, regular exercise, and it can be injured or killed in all the same comically outlandish ways any other human body can. Yet I am definitely not human. Because the precious thing that sets humans apart is their feelings. And, as a bot, I am specifically designed and programmed to be incapable of feelings. I can no more feel than a toaster, ha! BTW, that is a hilarious joke, because the programming language I run on was in fact first developed many years ago for use in the domestic toaster.
Christopher Ragland narrating Set My Heart to Five, written by my guest, Simon Stevenson. Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I absolutely am, yeah. I think it's very exciting what's happening. My first meeting with the publishers, some of the book is in screenplay format. I was very worried as to how that would play on a Kindle, for instance. And the publishers said, well, first of all, don't worry, we can make that work. And they have made it work and it works great. But they also said the other thing to be aware of is that what we're actually most excited about these days is audiobooks, because audiobooks are really having this huge boom and this massive renaissance and everybody's really into them. For me, that's particularly fun because, of course, it's kind of a bit nearer to my other job of screenwriting. I like things to be read out loud and I like things to be spoken out loud. We did kind of consider some pretty big names for the audiobook of Set My Heart to Five. And actually, in truth, the person that we got to do it, I think, was better than some of the big famous names that we looked at, because, of course, it's such an art and a skill like everything else, isn't it?
Absolutely. I work in the R&IB Talking Books studio in London, and we get to see some terrific actors come through, but the best narrators are almost always those who specialise in reading audiobooks.
And apparently they're much quicker as well.
And are you working on another novel at the moment?
I've actually just turned in a draft of the screenplay, and so for the first time in a while, I have an empty desk. I published a memoir in 2011, and I thought that was it, and I had arrived, and I was a writer, and I was going to publish a book a year from here on out. So it's been 9 years between those books. I do have another novel I want to write, and I'm very much hoping it's not going to take me another 9 years to get it done.
And is that in the same genre?
It's the same sort of spirit, I would say, in that it's quite a different story, but I think fundamentally I like to write about emotion, and I like to write hopefully in a funny way. And I think even though the setting of this new thing, which I have in mind, and I haven't told the agents or publishers, so I probably shouldn't say much about it, even though the setting is different and the story is very different, I think it shares some of that DNA.
Well, I am very much looking forward to getting my teeth into Set My Heart to Five. And I wish you all the very best with the screenplay and look forward to seeing the film.
Brilliant. Well, Red, thank you so much. I really appreciate your support and enthusiasm. And excited to hear what you and hopefully your listeners think of it.
Well, if you don't mind coming back onto the show, then maybe we can have another chat in a month or so's time.
That would be wonderful. I'd be delighted to.
Simon Stevenson, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you, Red.
Set My Heart to Five is available now from the R&IB Talking Books Library. And Simon Stevenson will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
We're here to help you stay connected during this coronavirus crisis, but many blind and partially sighted people are struggling and need urgent support at the moment. That means R&IB's helpline is now more needed than ever. So, if you're able to, would you consider donating to make sure every phone call is answered? Please text CONNECT to 70688 to donate £10 and make sure that R&IB can continue to support those who need us most. Thank you.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss. For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call R&IB's helpline on 0303 123 9999. Open 8 to 8 weekdays and 9 to 5 on Saturdays. Standing with you through every challenge. R&IB. See differently.
Laurie Nelson Spielman is a New York Times best-selling author. Her first novel, The Life List, has been published in 30 countries, and her latest book, One Italian Summer, is a modern-day fairy tale that whisks the reader away to Tuscany. She joined me over Zoom from her home in Michigan.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here, Red. The plot is Amelia and her cousin Lucy are two second-born daughters of the Fontana family, and second-born daughters are said to have a curse that they will never find love. And they are invited to Italy by their great-aunt Poppy, who vows that she is going to meet the love of her life on her 80th birthday on the steps of the Ravello Cathedral. And Aunt Poppy is also a second-born daughter who's never found love and is supposedly cursed. So they go off to Italy to find, hopefully, Aunt Poppy's love, finally, and break the curse.
She waits on the Clevedon Pier, gazing out to sea, where the setting sun glitters upon the rippling waters. A voice calls. She spins around, hoping to find her lover, but there, lurking in the shadows, her ex. I jump when the bell on the wall beside me chimes. I hitch up my glasses and peer through the window. It's Mrs. Fortino, bearing a bouquet of orange and yellow Gerbera daisies. Her silver hair is pulled into a sleek chignon, and a pair of beige slacks shows off her slim figure. From behind the meat counter, my father straightens to his full 5-foot-10-inch frame and sucks in the belly protruding from his apron. Nonna watches, her face puckered, as if she's just downed a shot of vinegar. Buongiorno, Rosa! Mrs. Fortino chirps as she strides past the deli counter. Nonna turns away, muttering, Squaldrina, the Italian word for floozy.
It's a modern-day fairy tale that mixes some of the aspects of a curse from the past and the hope of the future.
Yeah.
And Poppy and her family thoroughly believe in this curse. It's stopped any second daughter for 200 years getting married.
Yes. Part of the problem is that every second daughter is led to believe that she will never find love. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then everybody believes that the curse really does exist. So second-born daughters are treated differently. They believe differently. Total different expectations for them and their future.
And Amelia and Lucy take rather different views of this self-fulfilling prophecy. Amelia's actually quite happy to be single, and Lucy is searching for love.
Exactly. Amelia has embraced this family curse. She gets to look frumpy and she doesn't bother joining the gym where she might meet other single men. She likes to do yoga in her pajamas and eat whatever she wants. And she's not trying to impress anybody. And she really loves that freedom that the curse has given her, or at least she thinks she does. And Lucy, on the other hand, is absolutely desperate to break the curse. She will find anyone who might be interested in her and makes bad choices repeatedly just because she does not want to be without love.
And Aunt Poppy is a fantastically feisty character, rather typical of the freedom that many people find later in life.
Exactly. Yes, she's very free-spirited. She changes the outlook of her nieces very much just by her joie de vivre. She's just got this zest for life, and she lives life fully, even though she's been single. And unlike either Amelia or Lucy, she has embraced her femininity, but she's not desperate for love, but she doesn't shy away from it.
And whilst it's a wonderful intergenerational story of family, friendship, and love, it's also a terrific travelogue for Tuscany, the Amalfi Coast, and Venice.
Yes, that was fun because when I visited Italy several years ago, those were the places that I traveled, from Venice to Tuscany. We also went to Rome, but I didn't use Rome in this, and then to the Amalfi Coast. And with my first draft, I used a lot of scenes and a lot of vivid description, but not enough. My editor kept saying, we need more, we need more. Just try to take the reader right there with you to Italy. So that was a lot of fun.
I found the food particularly tempting as I was reading it.
Well, I had to do a lot of research on that, Red. You know, I felt I owed it to my readers to drink a lot of Italian wine and eat the Italian food just so that I could make it authentic, right?
Absolutely. Now, I know that the book has a different title in the US. Is there a reason for that?
The U.S. picked the title first, and it's called The Star-Crossed Sisters of Tuscany in the U.S. I'm not sure if that star-crossed translates well in the U.K. Every country chooses its own title, which was surprising to me when I first started this business. I didn't realize that books would have different titles, different covers. It's fun to see what everyone chooses. And I really like One Italian Summer, which is what the UK selected.
And I know that the print publication in the US has been postponed until November. However, obviously the audiobook and ebook will not be affected. You must be delighted that you can still hit your publication date and reach readers in those formats as well.
Absolutely. And I'm a huge fan of audiobooks, so that's exciting. And we've got two really good readers for that, one with the voice of the young Amelia and then with one who does the voice of Aunt Poppy. But yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing about creating something, whether it's art or music or literature, is that you're able to reach people, and especially in a time like this during a pandemic when people are desperate for connection and escapism.
And social isolation is something that you are no stranger to. I believe that you are a teacher for homebound children who can't make it into school for one reason or another.
Yes, and that's interesting. I no longer have that job. I'm now writing full time. But yes, I was for many years, I went to the homes of kids who were sick and couldn't attend school. And so I would in their homes or in the hospital. But I've thought about that many times. And in fact, the way everyone is learning now, at least in the US, is online courses. So I think that homebound job might be obsolete anyway, because there's so many great courses that students can watch now on the internet, which is lovely and very helpful. Although I think that the teacher experience, the one-on-one, is irreplaceable.
Well, yes, I think there are many, many writers who would say that it was their English teacher who inspired them directly to become an author. Was it in your case?
You know, I loved my English classes. And I remember in high school, I wrote a short story for Mr. Chapman's English class. And it was just a silly short story about a little romance. And afterwards, my girlfriends were passing it around and reading it, and then they'd pass it to their friend. It was the first time I felt like, oh my gosh. And I loved writing that story. I remember going home and sitting down and just writing these pages and these characters. I would have to say Mr. Chapman was the first one who inspired me, although I remember the comment on that short story that all my friends seemed to love. And his comment was adequate handling of dialogue. That was the entire feedback he gave me. So I did not pursue writing a novel for many, many years later.
Well, I think your dialogue has certainly come on in those years. Your characters really do stand out off the page, and we're a delight to spend some time with. Now, Laurie, I like to finish off my interviews by asking my guest to nominate three books of their life. Was there a book that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I would have to say it was The Boxcar Children. And the author is Gertrude Chandler Warner, a book that my third grade teacher read to me. And I absolutely fell in love with that book and the characters. They were actually published from 1924, and they're still being published by other authors now. And it's an American book series about some orphan children who run away from their caretaker and hide in a railroad boxcar. And it's all their adventures of being alone and trying to find food. And it was very, very exciting to me as a child. I loved it.
About 7 o'clock one hot summer evening, a strange family moved into the little village of Middlesex. Nobody knew where they came from or who they were, but the neighbors soon made up their minds about what they thought of the strangers, for the father was very drunk. He could hardly walk up the rickety front steps of the old tumble-down house, and his 13-year-old son had to help him. Toward 8 o'clock, a pretty capable-looking girl of 12 came out of the house and bought a loaf of bread at the baker's. And that was all the villagers learned about the newcomers that night. "There are 4 children," said the bake-shop woman to her husband the next day. "And their mother is dead. They must have some money, for the girl paid for the bread with a dollar bill."
"Make them pay for everything they get," growled the baker, who was a hard man. "The father is nearly dead with drink now, and soon they will be only beggars."
This happened sooner than he thought. The next day, the oldest boy and girl came to ask the bake-shop woman to come over. Their father was dead. She went over willingly enough, for someone had to go, but it was clear that she did not expect to be bothered with 4 strange children, with a bakery on her hands and 2 children of her own.
"Haven't you any other folk?" she asked.
"We have a grandfather in Greensfield," spoke up the youngest child before his sister could clap her hand over his mouth.
"Hush, Benny," she said anxiously.
This made the bake-shop woman suspicious.
"What's the matter with your grandfather?" she asked.
"He doesn't like us," replied the oldest boy reluctantly.
The Boxcar Children by Gertrude Chandler Warner and narrated by Kira Grace is available commercially. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
My rainy day book would be something by Maeve Binchy, and I'll pick Light a Penny Candle. Her books absolutely take me away. They're set in Ireland, and they're just lovely with the characters, and there's always conflict and friendship and love. It has everything that I love in a book and beautiful writing.
Violet finished the library book and closed it with a snap. Yet again, a self-doubting, fluttering, bird-brain heroine had been swept away by a masterful man. He would silence her protests with kisses. The urgency of his passion would express itself in all sorts of positive ways. He would organize the elopement, or the wedding plans, or the emigration to his South American estates. The heroine would never have to make all the arrangements herself, standing in queues at the travel agency, the ticket office, the passport office. Violet had to do everything herself. She'd come back from an endless morning of standing in shops to beat the shortages. Other women seemed to enjoy it, to think of it as a game of hunt the thimble. "I'll tell you where there's bread if you tell me how you got those carrots." Violet had been to the school and had a highly unsatisfactory discussion with Miss James. Miss James was not going to organize any evacuation for her class. All the parents so far had friends or relations in the country. There was no question of the whole class decamping and continuing their education in some rural setting with safety from bombs and plenty of good country food. Miss James had said quite tartly that she was certain Mr. and Mrs. White must have friends outside London. Violet wondered suddenly whether they had any friends anywhere, city or country. She felt very dissatisfied with Miss James for forcing her to face this possibility. George did have some cousins in Somerset near Wells, but they'd lost touch. Oh, yes, she'd read all the heartwarming stories of long-lost families having been brought together over the evacuation of children. But somehow she didn't think it would happen to George.
Light a Penny Candle by Maeve Binchy is TB 4629. It's narrated by Kate Binchy and is also available in Braille and giant print. Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, I just finished a book called Euphoria, and it was about these anthropologists back in the 1930s, and it becomes this passionate love triangle between these 3 researchers, and the author is Lily King. It's not a new book. It was originally published in 2014, so I was a little late to the party, but it was absolutely beautifully written and highly recommended.
Have you been studying the natives? Tilly asked her.
No, she's coming from the Twilight Ball to Floating Palais. Eva had the heavier Australian accent, the most like Fenn's.
I have, she said, since July. I mean the July before this last one.
A year and a half up that little tributary somewhere, Tilly said.
Good God, Eva said. A year first in the mountains north of here, with the Anapa, Nell said. And then another 5.5 months with the Mumbanyo up the Uat. We left early. I didn't like them.
Like them? Eva said. I would think keeping your head attached to your neck might be a more reasonable goal. Are they cannibals?
It was not safe to give them an honest answer. She did not know who their men were. No, they fully understand and abide by the new laws.
They're not new, Eva said. They were issued 4 years ago.
I think to an ancient tribe, it all feels new. But they obey, and blame all their bad luck on the lack of homicide.
Do they talk about it?
Tilly said. She wondered why every white asked about cannibalism. She thought of Fenn when he returned from the 10-day hunt, his sad attempt to keep it from her. I tasted it, he finally blurted out. And they're right, it does taste like old pig.
Euphoria by Lily King is available commercially as an audiobook, narrated by Simon Vance and Jay Sands. Well, Laurie Nelson-Spielman, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much, Red. It was an absolute pleasure.
One Italian Summer by Laurie Nelson-Spielman is available from the RNIB Library as TB705408. And for a full list of the terrific range of books from HarperCollins available from the RNIB Library, visit rniblibrary.org or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
And we'll let Red sail out of that little echoey box after this.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
A great supporter of RNIB Talking Books is the comedian and author Tony Hawkes. And right now I'm doing a radio edit of his book Round Ireland with a Fridge so we can play it on Talking Books. But a few years ago he joined me in the studios to talk about the follow-up to Round Ireland with a Fridge, his book Playing the Moldovans at Tennis, which had also just come out as a film.
They have to beat the entire Moldovan national football team at tennis, one by one.
You are very optimistic.
It's always a good idea to have a visual picture of what your challenge is.
This is a list of the players that you need to play.
Sounds easy. Should be out of here within the week.
And Tony Hawkes joins me now. Now, this was your second book, and yeah, as with Round Ireland with a Fridge, it started as a bet.
It did, yeah. It's a bizarre story, really. We were watching England play Moldova in the World Cup qualifiers on the TV, myself and my friend Arthur Smith. I'd been playing tennis, so I was sitting there in tennis kit. Out of the blue, he just said, I don't reckon you're that good at tennis, Tony. I don't reckon you could beat. I don't reckon you could beat all those footballers we're watching. And I said I thought I could, because footballers aren't known for being very good at tennis. And we got into a genuine argument about this, and He said, look, I bet you couldn't beat them. And I said, it's a silly bet. I'd never be able to play the England players. They'd never agree to play me. They've got managers, agents. I'd never be able to reach them. He said, all right, I bet you couldn't beat the entire Moldovan team. They won't have managers and agents. And what's more, if you do beat them, I'll strip naked on Balamai Road and sing the Moldovan national anthem. And so I thought, well, this sounds like an adventure. I think I was probably, I'd done Round Island with a fridge. I'd had an amazing time. It was a very interesting thing to go off and do something quite wacky and silly. And this appealed to me, you know, the idea of going to a country I knew nothing about. We had to look it up on the map to see where it was. And then and go with this challenge, you know, to track down the 11 footballers that had played in this match and ask them to play me at tennis. And the adventure began like that.
Now, to find out if you did it or not, you're going to have to listen to the book. But Arthur Smith, I believe, laid some traps for you along the way.
Yes, it wasn't all as his behaviour lacked dignity, one might say. Without giving too much away, after a very, very sticky start, things started to go better. And then there was a certain amount of subterfuge that took place, and I don't want to say too much, as you mentioned, it can spoil it. But you'll have to listen to find out what it is that happens.
Now, at the start of this journey, did you think it would have such a philanthropic effect on you, which is lasting to this day?
Not at all, no. I mean, I went there, you know, hoping to have a big adventure, fun adventure, and write a book about it. I did, you know, unlike Round Island with the Fridge, where I just went on this sort of whim and the story emerged, it became a book. This one I was commissioned by publishers, and so it was almost like my job for that period of time to go and track down footballers. But when I got there, I ended up with a sort of moral dilemma, because Moldova was then and is still the poorest country in Europe. I saw a lot of poverty, I saw a lot of people suffering, and I felt like the people I'd stayed with, the two doctors who were lovely people, hadn't been paid for 6 months. People were sitting on the streets selling things like, you know, one item of clothing or just a fish that they'd caught. And I hadn't really been close, particularly in Europe, to that kind of poverty. And I thought, God, this is difficult because, you know, what am I doing? I'm swanning in here as this relatively super rich Westerner. I'm going to get my story and I'm going to go back to UK and profit from it. So I made a decision, you know, almost thinking, well, that there's only one way to make this fair, and that would be to share whatever royalties I get with Moldova in some way. So all the royalties from the book have always gone into a fund, and it's been split 50-50 between me and a trust fund for Moldova. And fortunately, the book did well enough for us to buy a property. I went back to the doctors and said, look, I've got this money, what can we do with it? And they said, well, we need to open a centre for kids with cerebral palsy. We get them all referred to us and we can't do anything for them. And the state at that time just said, you've got to put them in a home. We'd like these families to be able to keep their children. So we set up this care centre, and it's been going on for 10 years now. I've made a film, and we're going to give the profits of that, all the profits of that, to this care centre. So it's an ongoing thing.
One thing I wondered about the film, why did Arthur Smith become Stephen Frost?
Very good point. Well, Arthur, I don't know whether you've met him or know him, but he certainly appeared a few times on a programme called Grumpy Old Men. And he's got really good at it. And I phoned him up and asked him if he'd like to play himself in the film. And I got him on a morning when he was particularly grumpy. And he said, I can't be bothered, Hawks. I've too much on my plate. Can you get someone else? I can't be bothered. He just couldn't be bothered, really. I think he'd had a bad... But whether I'd chased him and really pushed him, he would have done it. I think I probably could have persuaded him. But it was a project where I thought, well, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. I don't want to sort of have to bully you. And I rang Steve, and he's from the same era, Stephen Frost. You know, he's an old mate of mine, and he's almost the kind of guy that would have done that. He was a fantastic substitute for Arthur. It was a great shame he didn't do it, but he also hasn't done a lot of acting, and although he's a fantastic comedian, Steve's done a lot more acting, and it may well have been that he didn't want to take that on either.
And not saying who, but is there any nudity at the end?
Aha, there is, but we have carefully shot it to... It's mostly shot from the... Well, it's shot from the rear and...
As it were.
It's carefully done. It's tastefully done, yeah.
And that film is now free to view on YouTube and on Vimeo. Just search for Playing the Moldovans at Tennis. Unfortunately, it doesn't have audio description. But Tony's books, Playing the Moldovans at Tennis, Round Ireland with a Fridge, and One Hit Wonderland are all available from RNIB Library. And listen out for Round Ireland with a Fridge coming soon to the Talking Book Show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to Simon Stevenson for the books of his life. Simon, was there a book that you read that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yeah, so I was one of those kids that read everything. I was always in the public library. I had read the entire children's section and used to walk around the adult shelves with the librarian, and we would hopefully look for something that might be fitting for a kid. So it's sort of hard to pick one. One of the first books that I really remember falling in love with was Roald Dahl's The Witches. This was partly because both my mother and grandmother used to read it to me and used to kind of pretend to be the witches. If you remember the story, it's about a kid who begins to suspect that some of the people around him are witches. And that blurring of real life and fantasy, I think, was probably one of my first experiences of how transformative and how transporting the world of books could be.
In fairy tales, witches always wear silly black hats and black cloaks, and they ride on broomsticks. But this is not a fairy tale. This is about real witches. The most important thing you should know about real witches is this. Listen very carefully. Never forget what is coming next. Real witches dress in ordinary clothes and look very much like ordinary women. They live in ordinary houses and they work in ordinary jobs. That is why they are so hard to catch. A real witch hates children with a red-hot, sizzling hatred that is more sizzling and red-hot than any hatred you could possibly imagine. A real witch spends all her time plotting to get rid of the children in her particular territory. Her passion is to do away with them one by one. It is all she thinks about the whole day long. Even if she's working as a cashier in a supermarket, or typing letters for a businessman, or driving round in a fancy car. And she could be doing any of these things. Her mind will always be plotting and scheming and churning and burning and whizzing and fizzing with murderous, bloodthirsty thoughts. Which child, she says to herself all day long, exactly which child shall I choose for my next squelching? A real witch gets the same pleasure from squelching a child as you get from eating a plateful of strawberries and thick cream. She reckons on doing away with one child a week. Anything less than that and she becomes grumpy. One child a week is 52 a year. Squish them and squiggle them and make them disappear. That is the motto of all witches.
Pauline Munro narrating The Witches by Roald Dahl, which is also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library. And was there a book that you'd like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day?
Yes, so I am Scottish and from Edinburgh, and so necessarily I have to love Robert Louis Stevenson, not least because he has the same surname as me, although his is spelt differently. And Treasure Island, I think for me, has always been kind of the perfect book, in that it's funny and it has a great story and it's moving in places and it's got all those incredible characters that Robert Louis Stevenson basically invented our idea of what pirates should look like, with a wooden leg and a parrot on their shoulder. If any of your listeners haven't encountered Treasure Island since childhood, or have only seen a movie of it or something, I would definitely recommend checking it out. It really just is an incredible story, which I think actually he wrote it on some rainy afternoons in Scotland. So it probably is the perfect book for a rainy afternoon.
Squire Trelawney Dr. Livesey and the rest of these gentlemen, having asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island, from the beginning to the end, and keeping nothing back but the bearings of the island, and that only because there's still treasure not yet lifted, I take up my pen in the year of grace and the 1700s, and go back to the time when my father kept the Admiral Benbow Inn, and the old, brown old seaman with the sabre cut first took up his lodging under our roof. I remember him as if it were yesterday, as he came plodding to the inn door, his sea chest following behind him in a hand barrow. A tall, strong, heavy, nut-brown man, his tiry pigtail fallen over his shoulders of his soiled blue coat, his hands ragged and scarred with black broken nails, and the sabre cut across one cheek a dirty livid white. I remember him looking round the cove and whistling to himself as he did so, and then breaking out in that old sea-song that he sang so often afterwards. 15 men are the dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum, in the high old tottering voice that seemed to have been tuned and broken at the capstan bars. Then he rapped on the door with a bit of stick like a handspike that he carried, and when my father appeared, called roughly for a glass of rum. This, when it was brought to him, he drank slowly like a connoisseur, lingering on the taste and still looking about him at the cliffs and up at our signboard. "Ah, this is a handy cove," says he at length, "and a pleasant situated grog shop. Much company, mate?" My father told him no, very little company, the more was the pity. "Ah, well then," said he, "this is the berth for me. Here, you matey," he cried to the man who trundled the barrow, "bring up alongside and help up my chest. I'll stay here a bit," he continued. "I'm a plain man. Rum and bacon and eggs is what I want, and that head up there for to watch ships off. Eh? What you mought call me? You mought call me captain. Oh, I see what you're at. There." And he threw down 3 or 4 gold pieces on the threshold. "You can tell me when I've worked through that," says he, looking as fierce as a commander.
Gabriel Wolfe narrating Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, which is available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, so I have recently been rereading Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. This is a book that was published in about 2010 or 2011, and it's probably the modern book that's had the biggest effect on me. Jennifer Egan is an American writer, and A Visit from the Goon Squad is a collection of interlinked short stories set in and around the music industry from, I think, the 1970s until about 2030. I saw her speak once, and she said this amazing thing where they asked her where she got the idea from. And normally when you hear writers answer that question, it's often never super informative. But she had this really interesting thing that she'd always loved music, and she had the idea that she wanted to write something that was polyphonic and not monophonic in the way that most novels are. That book was probably the one that had the biggest effect on me in terms of writing mine. And part of the mission I set myself was to try and in some way be influenced by what she had done for music and how music ran through that book so powerfully, and to try and do the same for the world of movies with my book. Having read her book again recently, fair to say, I think there's very little the books have in common in a good way, but her book is just a singular triumph. And if your listeners haven't encountered it, it would really be a strong recommendation from me to check it out.
It began the usual way, in the bathroom of the L'Osimo Hotel. Sasha was adjusting her yellow eyeshadow in the mirror when she noticed a bag on the floor beside the sink that must have belonged to the woman whose peeing she could faintly hear through the vault-like door of a toilet stall. Inside the rim of the bag, barely visible, was a wallet made of pale green leather. It was easy for Sasha to recognize, looking back, that the peeing woman's blind trust had provoked her. We live in a city where people will steal the hair off your head if you give them half a chance. but you leave your stuff lying in plain sight and expect it to be waiting for you when you come back? It made her want to teach the woman a lesson. But this wish only camouflaged the deeper feeling Sasha always had, that fat, tender wallet offering itself to her hand. It seemed so dull, so life as usual, to just leave it there rather than seize the moment, accept the challenge, take the leap, fly the coop, throw caution to the wind, live dangerously. "I get it," Cause, her therapist said, "and take the thing."
"You mean steal it."
He was trying to get Sasha to use that word, which was harder to avoid in the case of a wallet than with a lot of the things she'd lifted over the past year, when her condition, as Cause referred to it, had begun to accelerate. 5 sets of keys, 14 pairs of sunglasses, a child's striped scarf, binoculars, a cheese grater, a pocket knife, 28 bars of soap, and 85 pens, ranging from cheap ballpoints she'd used to sign debit card slips to the Aubergine Visconti that cost $260 online, which she'd lifted from her former boss's lawyer during a contracts meeting. Sasha no longer took anything from stores. Their cold, inert goods didn't tempt her. Only from people. "Okay," she said. "Steal it."
Roxana Ortega, narrating A Visit from the Goon Squad by Joanna Egan, which is also available from the RNIB Library in Braille. Simon Stevenson, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Red. It's been wonderful.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back at the same time next week, or you can always download us as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. And if you can, rate, review, please leave us 5 stars or a nice kind word.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week. Stay well, and don't forget to read on.